Das from the set, the title of my talk is M-theory and G2 manifolds. And my talk is based on the set of papers that I wrote over there on that blackboard. The first one written in collaboration with Daniel Robbins and Edward Witten last year, and some recent papers written in collaboration with Melanie and Daniel. As I will explain towards the end of the talk, this is a very rich story, and we only discovered the tip of the iceberg. So the dots over there stand for work in progress and hopefully to appear. And so let me explain the question we would like to answer. So in 11-dimensional supergravity, a solution of the equations of motion is a space time, is a flat space-time times a manifold M, 7-dimensional, which we are going to take to be compact, 7-dimensional, Ricci flat manifold. RAB is equal to 0. And say we have vanishing G4 flux. Now, supersymmetry is unbroken in space-time if we have a parallel spinner along M. Supersymmetry is unbroken if we have a parallel spinner along M. So in this case, the metric on M, it has a G2 holonomy. Now, it turns out that 11-dimensional supergravity is only the low energy limit of M theory, and we expect an infinite series of corrections to the two derivative action that in this case would be suppressed by the inverse radius of M. So a natural question we can ask, let me call this question one, is thus the classical solution lift to a solution of M theory. Well, this is of course a question that we can ask in the context of M theory, in the context of string theory, for supersymmetric compactifications to any number of dimensions. So there is a related question here, which would be question two. Can the classical solution of G2 holonomy be modified to compensate the alpha prime corrections to, let's say, equations of motion and, let's say, supersymmetric transformations? So, okay, we want to. Sorry? No, so I said here in string theory. So this is why I said a moment ago that we can ask the same question in the context of string theory. So here I'm thinking about, say, type 2 string theory and about alpha prime corrections. Okay? So we can ask this in M theory, we can ask this in string theory. So, and depending on the part of the talk, I'm actually going to switch back and forth between M theory and type 2 string theory. You are going to see why. Now, so what do we want to do? We want to come up with an existence proof of some alpha prime corrected equations. So the next question, or the first question we might want to ask, well, how do the equations look like? How do the alpha prime corrected equations look like? Well, in string theory, we have tools to compute alpha prime corrections to effective actions and to supersymmetry transformations. But we are interested in an infinite series of alpha prime corrections, and those are not known in a closed form. So basically, the answer to this question is we do not know. Now, However, as it turns out, we do not need to know the details of these alpha prime corrections to come up with an existence proof. We do not need to know the details. To explain what I mean, let me review or let me recall the following classic theorem in mathematics, the Hodge decomposition theorem. So say let M be a compact oriented Riemannian manifold. And let HP be the set of harmonic forms. So EP over here are the smooth P forms. And HP are the harmonic forms. So delta is the Laplacian acting on forms, dd dagger plus d dagger d. Then the following holds. First of all, HP is finite dimensional. And we have the following orthogonal direct sum decomposition of the smooth P forms into something that we write as a Laplacian acting on a P form and harmonic forms. Now, why is this relevant? Because it tells us that the PDE, Laplacian acting on some form equal to alpha, has a solution if alpha is orthogonal to all elements in HP, if alpha is orthogonal to all harmonic forms. So in order to know that a solution exists, all we need to know is that this alpha is orthogonal to all harmonic forms. But we do not need to know the details about alpha. So let me give you an overview of the talk. So let's call what just happened introduction. So my talk will basically have two parts. In the first part, I will show that the how to reduce solving the alpha prime corrected supersymmetry transformations to an equation of Laplace type. So reduce. Well, this is a general theorem, so this has nothing to do with
d2-holonomy.
So we're going to reduce the alpha prime corrected supersymmetry transformations to an Laplace equation. So basically, I still have to show the connection between the questions 1 and 2 over here and what I just said over there. So this will be basically the content of part one. Now, in part two, now even if it's just a Laplace equation, solvability is not for free. So we need, for example, that alpha is orthogonal to all harmonic forms. So we need certain cohomology conditions, and we need those to all orders in alpha prime. So in order to motivate why those cohomology conditions hold, I'm going to use space-time physics. So let me start with part one. So let's see, a basic tool to understand spaces like this on which parallel spinors can be defined are tensors constructed as spinor bilinears. So in the present case, where there's a three form, that takes this form. So this over here are gamma matrices. And these over here are indices tangent to M. And there is a Hodge dual. Now, in order to write these expressions over here, I need, so to satisfy Clifford algebra, so I need a metric and I need a spinor. Now, but it turns out that the three form itself is actually the more fundamental object. So if I'm just given a three form, so the three form, so phi is, let me call it, say it like this, more fundamental than the metric. Since if I have a space and I'm just given the three form phi, then I can construct an expression for the metric in the following way. Where SAB can be, well, that's some number. And it is just constructed from the, so we need a globally defined three form, of course, phi RST. And this over here is the Levi-Civita symbol, which takes values plus minus one. So if I'm just in a space, I know that I have a globally defined three form, then this object over here defines a metric, assuming that it satisfies that the signs work out correctly, so that this really qualifies us, that we can construct a good volume from here. So so this spinor turns out to be parallel. So then, of course, from that definition over there, it follows that phi is closed and it is co-closed. So that is the classical solution. So this is what we would have to leading order in alpha prime for very large volume in M3. But now what we would like to do is to study alpha prime corrections to this. So since we do not know the expression for the alpha prime corrections to all orders in alpha prime, all I can do, including alpha prime corrections, so all I can do is to write down the most general expression and which schematically takes the following forms. So we have the Gravitino transformation on the internal space. So this over here would be the classical contribution. And these over here are the alpha prime corrections. So here we are using the fact that in seven dimensions, a spinor has eight real components. So I can take as a basis in the space of spinors my parallel spinor eta and maybe this set of spinors over here. So we have eight spinors in our basis. So this, what this is an expansion of an arbitrary spinor in terms of this basis. Now this object over here, A, are some tensors which are functionals of the three form. So in general, I think of them maybe as expressions given by Riemann tensors. But since the metric is expressed in terms of phi, I can basically reduce everything to just being tensors written in terms of phi, not in terms of the metric. So what do we know about this object A and B? Well, we actually do have explicit expressions for them to order alpha prime cubed. And if you want to see, so at order alpha prime cubed. So these have been computed in the literature. And it turns out that A is equal to 0. And I'm not going to write the complete thing. It starts at order alpha prime cubed. And while there is some object Z, which contains three Riemann tensors, and I'm not going to, so all of this, so the details are in our paper. You can look them up. It is, so there's a tensor Z constructed out of three Riemann tensors. So there is a concrete expression we can look at. But beyond beyond order alpha prime cubed, we don't know how this looks like. Now, as I said, I want to set this problem up so that I do not need to use these concrete expressions, but it's good to have them, let's say, as a reality check to make sure that one is on the right track with this. So we are going to proceed without using any concrete expression. So let me sketch how we solve this, let's say. So we want to solve the supersymmetry transformations order by order in alpha prime. So let me sketch how we do this to order alpha prime cubed, and then I will say one sentence for orders in alpha prime at the end. So to at order alpha prime cubed, so let's try to be a little bit more precise here. And I'm going to add to the above equation a few primes. So we want to solve the equation that this is equal to 0. Now, so by prime, what I mean, so this is an object that has a leading order, and it has, let me call this maybe a delta eta here. So this is an object which is order alpha prime cubed. The same thing here, so there is in the spin connection, there is, the leading order metric and also a correction. Now, so primed objects are the ones that include alpha prime corrections. Now, the object over here, so this is the eta, the covariantly constant spinner, so or the parallel spinner of the D2 space, simply because this object A and B, well, A is zero anyway, but B already has an explicit order alpha prime here. So these objects are then constructed from the D2 holonomy 3 form. So from the 3 form of the D2 holonomy space. Like that. So basically, we want to solve this equation. Instead of doing that, we found it more convenient, instead of solving for the spinner directly, to solve for the 3 form that we can construct from eta prime. So there's, of course, then a prime 3 form. There are prime gamma matrices constructed from the prime metric. And there's a psi prime. So not that the Hodge dual, so that includes the metric. So I also have to put a prime on that. So basically, there is an equation determining our corrected spinner. But now I want to set up a new set of equations determining our corrected phi and the corrected psi so that they are related by this duality condition. Well, it's an easy enough exercise. So taking these as a definition to compute d phi prime, anti-symmetrize over the indices, and get that this is equal to some form alpha. In the same way, we take our 4 form d psi prime, which we can also construct from our spinner and gamma matrices. And this will be equal to some beta. Now, so if A is equal to 0, for example, if A happens to be equal to 0, then this object A, alpha and beta will be expressed in terms of A and B. So we get some complicated expressions with a bunch of indices like this. CDE. So, and if you want, you can, of course, then at order alpha prime cubed, compute alpha and beta directly using these expressions over there, but we won't do that. And of course, so the questions we want to solve is these two equations, and psi prime, so this is important, is equal to the dual of phi prime. Well, I called it beta not because it's a beta function. So this is just a Greek letter. So at this moment I see no relation. So these objects are expressed maybe in terms of this object over here, but how to compute, I mean, I don't see a direct connection. So you can probably compute them using a beta function, but okay, so basically the set of equations we want to solve are these over here. D phi prime is equal to alpha, d psi prime is equal to beta, and psi prime has to be the dual of phi prime. So the first condition that we see, if we want phi prime on, so we of course want globally defined solutions. So in order for phi prime and psi prime to be globally defined, alpha and beta have to be exact. So let me call this maybe star is solvable. Okay, I should say this differently. So for star to be solvable, we need alpha and beta to be exact. So alpha is equal to d chi, psi prime is equal to beta is equal to d psi with this gadgets here, chi and psi, globally defined. So, but then of course we can ask, so as I mentioned a moment ago, we don't know much about A and B. So we can ask, so why should this be the case? So at order alpha prime cubed, we simply check. So we have the concrete expressions over there on the board. We compute chi and psi, and at the end of the day, they are globally defined. But we know nothing about these objects we have no concrete expressions for n bigger than 3. So in the second part of the talk, I want to argue that these objects are, that chi and psi are exact based on conditions for unbroken supersymmetry in spacetime. So we use spacetime arguments. But for the moment, I'm going to proceed assuming that chi and psi are globally defined. So, okay, so let's solve. Well, the first equation is easy enough to solve because we simply said phi prime equal to phi of the G2 holonomy space, the object that is closed, phi plus chi. Now we are going to use our freedom to add to this any form that is d of an arbitrary two form. So b over here is a two form. Now the second equation. Now remember that this psi prime over here is a Hodge dual of phi. So this is d of star phi prime. And we are solving so to order alpha prime cubed. So this is equal to d xi. So what we do is to linearize this object over here. So there's a linearization, of course, because there's a linearization in phi prime because that is like chi plus db, which we imagine are order alpha prime cubed. But there's also linearization hidden here in the star prime. So basically, a small computation reveals that this is equal to star phi plus some odd looking numbers here. So the pi's are the projection onto different G2 representations. So this acting on delta phi, where this over here, let me call this delta phi. So basically, what we have just obtained is a partial differential equation for B. So let me write it up on this board. Pi 1 plus pi 7 minus pi 27 chi plus db is equal to big psi. So this is our second order linear PDE for B. But guess what? Even though it doesn't look like it, this is just the Laplace equation. Now, so there are a few technical details involved here, so I'm just going to explain how to do this in a few steps. So basically, So this over here again are the projections onto the different G2 representations, and this B at this moment is an arbitrary two form. In order to see that this is the Laplace equation, let me say this just with words. So we need a combination of decomposition into G2 representations and Hodge decomposition. So basically, this B can be written as a two-form in the 7, so can be decomposed as a two-form in the 7 and a two-form in the 14. The two-form in the 7 actually drops out, turns out to be a diffeomorphism, so we can, without loss of generality, take B to be in the 14, and moreover, because D is acting on this, we can take B to be co-closed. So basically, and in that case, so if, how shall I write this? Let me erase this line. So if B is in the 14, in lambda to 14, it turns out that, so this contribution over here is equal to 0. So this vanishes. This contribution is equal to 0. So basically, this reduces to an equation of Laplace type. So basically, that becomes d dagger. This might have been a little bit quick, but again, we have the details in our paper. This times db equal to d dagger rho for some source. But this over here is equal to 1. So after the dust settles, basically, our differential equation becomes the Hodge-Deram Laplacian acting on B is equal to d dagger rho. So this rho is some source. Pi 1 on chi. We take B to be in the 14. And we can take B to be co-closed. So a few remarks. First of all, that the source is always orthogonal to all harmonic forms. And moreover, D dagger rho is also a two-form in the 14. Now, most of this are, if you know how to do it, it's a straightforward computation. Finding it is a different story, but basically it's a concrete computation that is explained in our paper. So we reduce basically solving these equations, well, actually those equations over there, to an equation of Laplace type. The source on the right-hand side is orthogonal to all harmonic two forms. And moreover, we have to be a little bit careful because we are taking the B in the 14. We also have to check that the source on the right-hand side is in the 14. So this Laplace equation is always solvable. So Laplace equation is always solvable. So basically, this concludes the first part of the talk, where I reduce solving the alpha prime corrected spinor equation to an equation of Laplace type, and we can show solvability. So the only thing I still owe you is an explanation why, beyond order alpha prime cubed, this forms alpha and beta still or can still be exact forms. Questions? Okay, so then let me come to the second part of the talk and switch gears. Part two. So the goal is to show that the exactness of alpha and beta arise as conditions for unbroken supersymmetry. Now, so I've been talking so far about alpha prime corrections, and over here I have type 2A string theory in mind. Now I'm going to switch to an M3 description, simply because I'm interested in describing the space-time physics, which we get in lower dimensions. And it's much more economical to do this from the M3 perspective, because there are less fields. So for the rest of the talk, we think that similar arguments will apply then also to type 2A string theory. So this is just because it's more economical to describe the field content. So so we wish to describe fluctuations. So we wish to describe fluctuations. So by fluctuations, I mean massless, but also massive. So we want to describe actually all fields which arise in the compactification. So we wish to describe fluctuations for M3 around the background. Times M. So this is still the same compact seven dimensional manifold. So again, we want to describe massless and massive fields. So we need some guide. So there's of course many fields involved. So we need some kind of guiding principle to be able to write something down. So guiding principle. So we will have two guiding principles. First of all, manifest four-dimensional supersymmetry. So we want to keep four-dimensional supersymmetry manifest, which basically means we want to assemble all fields that arise from the compactification into 4D superfields. Now, the other guiding principle is going to be locality. Locality in space-time and along M. So we, of course, expect locality in space-time and all our fields, let me symbolically denote them by phi, are going to be, let's say, functions of the space-time coordinates. So that is usually done. But in our approach, we want, in addition, to keep locality along M manifest. So which basically means that we are going to let the fields also depend explicitly on Y. So there will be functions or forms along the internal space. For example, it can also be a form like this. So these are indices tangent to M. And instead of interpreting Y as a space-time or as a space coordinate, it's simply going to be a label. So we are basically dealing with with fields that are labeled that are labeled by a continuous label Y. So so then what do we have? So in 11 dimensions, so the 11 dimensional fields then decompose into, so let's say capital letters, these are 11 dimensional indices. So in 11 dimensions, we have a three form and we have a metric. So they decompose into the following set of space-time fields. So we can have, from the three form, we can have scalars in space-time, we can have vectors, a collection of tensors, antisymmetric tensors. From the metric, we get, again, scalars in space-time, we get more vectors, and we get spin two fields. So not so. And so this is the field content. Now it turns out that under the so in 11 dimensions we also have symmetries. We have diffeomorphism invariants. We have gauge transformations of the three form, and all of those give rise to different symmetries in four dimensions. And under the symmetries, all of these fields basically mix. Moreover, we have over here an object that seems particularly difficult. So we have a space-time graviton, but we actually have an infinite set of spin two fields. So most of them are massive because there's this Y dependence. So if you wish, you can think about these. If you compactify in a circle, for example, you could Fourier transform, and then you would get a whole tower of Kaluza-Klein states. So we don't want to do this Fourier transformation. We want to keep locality manifest. And so then we have all this massive spin two fields. Now, writing down an action for all these fields and all the symmetries. So this is all we get from 11-dimensional supergravity. This is certainly a tall order, and we have only been able to obtain part of this action. However, from what we know, so what we know suggests, but does not prove yet, so we are still working on this, that the cohomology conditions for alpha and beta over here follow from the conditions for unbroken supersymmetry. So let's do easy things first. So as we do when trying to construct, when we first learn, let's say, supersymmetric theories, so we start with a theory with global supersymmetry, and we can then try to work our way up. So how would we, in this framework, for example, describe a theory with global supersymmetry? Well, we have four-dimensional flat superspace. With coordinates, let's say x, mu, and theta, we have some four-dimensional Majorana spinor. So then the next thing we want is to write down superfields in four dimensions. So superfields are going to be functions of our coordinates and superspace coordinates. Now, one of the most basic fields are the chiral superfields, which basically we can define exactly in the same way as we do in ordinary supersymmetry, because this basically just involves this coordinate here. And we are not bothered by the fact that this phi might depend on a continuous label. And maybe we also have some complex conjugate fields that are annihilated by the left-handed component of the superderivative. Now, so what could this chiral superfield be for us? So the lowest component has to be a complex field. So that's basically just from what I've written there on the board, there's only one choice. So for us, let me say it like this. For us, well, this chiral superfield will be like this. So it will be a three form, depending on x, depending on theta, and carrying a continuous label. So there is a lowest component, let me call it C. And then there's, of course, all the theta expansion. Now, the lowest component of the superfield will be a three form. Now, I'm going to be to call it phi, but still put a hat on this, because this object will be closely related, but not identical, to the phi we found over here. Plus, so you have to remember one thing, as I explained at the beginning of the talk, that this metric over here, the field that we obtain from the metric, so this is not the fundamental object, but the fundamental object is more like a free form ABC. So and then basically, so we can combine this in this way to construct the lowest component of a chiral superfield. And then, of course, in this superfield formulation, we have all the additional fermionic stuff. So what is the next thing we learn when we see supersymmetry for the first time? Well, we learn how to write down an action. So given, let's say, chiral superfields like this, so what kind of action can we? So the two basic interactions we might want to consider, maybe something like this. So we have a real function depending on phi and phi dagger. and we take the D term, so this transforms by a total derivative under supersymmetry transformation. Or we can take an F term plus the complex conjugate, some holomorphic function of phi. Now, and to get a little bit sense of this formula, so it's basically like conventional supersymmetry, except for this continuous labor. So to get a sense of what kind of result we expect, so we can expand this in components, and maybe we'll get a Lagrangian density that might look like this. So nothing wrong with this. So we have, now we have to include integrals over y. This is like a sum over this continuous label. Now, and this is basically a copy of what we get in conventional supersymmetry. Now, just imagine I'm suppressing here a few indices on C. So there's an auxiliary field. So this is basically the action we would get for the bosonic fields, df of c by dc times f of y. Now, so we still want this to be a local expression. So even though there are two integrals here, so we want, let's say, a Lagrangian that is only or Lagrangian density that is only one integral over y. We have to take into account that we expect this k and also phi to be integrals on M on the internal space. So basically, this contains a delta function. So this integral over here collapses only to one integral over the internal space. So what could this object be, f and k? Well, for f, there's basically just one expression that is compatible with all the symmetries. So let's talk, this F is of course the superpotential. So there's basically just one choice up to constant. This is phi, which d phi. So this is the exterior derivative along M. So this is very much constrained because we want, in perturbation theory, we want the result to be gauge invariant. So it should be invariant under shifts of this like imaginary part. So this descends from gauge invariance in 11 dimensions. We cannot write down anything where we use a metric to contract indices because the metric depends only on the real part of this field. So this object, so in a moment, it will be closely related to the three form phi. So basically, this is all we can write down. So and the conditions for unbroken supersymmetry, so in a supersymmetry ground state, well, df by d phi has to be zero, which basically means that d phi is zero, so d phi hat is equal to zero, and dc is, of course, g4, so g4 is zero. So let's compare this with the results we previously needed, so previously. So we wanted to have, so this was the three form on the three form phi prime. This was equal to alpha. And we wanted this to be equal to d chi. So it's basically, so we can translate this into saying that d of phi actually this was more like a phi prime. It was the corrected fellow. So d phi prime minus chi has to be equal to zero. So basically, it's tempting to identify this phi hat with our phi prime minus chi. Now, the good thing is that, so this were, let's say, results that we can explicitly check if you want, if we using the results for A and B that I mentioned a moment ago to order alpha prime cube. But what we are saying here is that there should exist a closed tree form on the space to all orders in alpha prime. So no matter how complicated this corrections to the effective action in 10 dimensions or 11 dimensions look like. So our claim is that there should always be a closed tree form. Questions? So so let's say something about K. So F was basically very much constrained by symmetries. Now, so K is, so its form is probably not constrained that much because it can depend on phi and phi dagger. But symmetries are actually enough. So let me explain what I mean. So let's talk about the Keeler potential. So as in conventional supersymmetry, so this complex fields are coordinates on an, in this case, infinite dimensional complex manifold. So K defines a Keeler metric, so is a Keeler potential, defines a Keeler metric and a Keeler form. So K defines a Keeler form, which I can write like this. Again, there are two integrals here, but basically this derivative here contains a delta function, delta c star of y prime. So, which delta c star of y prime. Now, so basically, it's the same way we obtain given a Keeler potential, how we write down the Keeler form, except we have to get used to all these integrals and know that the space is infinite dimensional. But otherwise, it's the same thing. And to emphasize that this is just like the ordinary case, I'm going to use some condensed notation that is going to be practical in a moment. So I'm simply going to write this as J A B prime dyi. So this is basically symbolically. So if I write a sum over b prime, what I mean is it also includes an integral over y prime. So basically, there's a shorthand notation for all the thing that is basically like this. So we have a Keeler manifold, and this Keeler manifold has isometries, which descend from the symmetries of 11-dimensional supergravity. So the Keeler metric has isometries. So so we expect the Keeler form to be invariant under shifts of C. So remember that. So I'm suppressing all these indices A, B, and C. So, yes. So the lowest component of our superfield that was given over here, from the gauge transformations of the tree form in 11 dimensions, we get isometries of this metric. So remember the C is given by, this object that I call phi hat. Now, in the meantime, we sort of learned how phi hat is related to our phi prime. So this is like phi hat plus I times the ordinary C, the three form. So and the isometries act like this by sending C to C prime plus I d lambda. So it shifts the imaginary part of these of the coordinates. So so this leaves the Kähler metric invariant. So it's infinite dimensional manifold, but basically many roots that we use for ordinary manifolds, we simply, for example, replace derivative by functional derivative, a sum by an integral, so have basically a translation to this language. So now, so J is a tensor. So basically this form then transforms in the following way, plus D of I D lambda J plus I D lambda DJ. So this over here is like the contraction with D lambda. Now, so this part over here is equal to zero because we are dealing with a Kähler manifold. So according to the Poincaré lemma, we can locally write. So according to Poincaré lemma, so locally, so we can write I d lambda on J as d of some object that I'm going to call p d lambda, which is the, so this object over here, let me call it this killing potential. So it is basically a map P D lambda from V to C, where V is the vector space of two forms modulo closed two forms. Now, and moreover, this is a linear map. So since there's it is a linear map, we can actually also represent this killing potential in the following form. So this is the inner product of forms. So the standard inner product of forms, I should say. So we can write this map as lambda times mu. Now this object over here is famous in some in symplectic geometry. It is called the moment map. Now we are interested in this object mu because it's an important part of the action in superspace. Okay, maybe I can just leave this here. So this will be a nice summary of what we have derived previously. So this object is called the moment map. So this gadget is important for us again because it appears in the space-time action in superfluid language. So let me schematically write it like this. So there's a contribution to the space-time action, which is the product of a D term. times this moment map. So this is the auxiliary field of the vector multiplet containing C. So, and basically on shell, integrating out D. So there's of course a term that is like D square. So integrating out D and requiring and using unbroken supersymmetry sets mu equal to zero. Now, I have to jump over a few steps, and there are more details here. We have to think about K a little bit more in detail. But basically, again, the details in our paper, we can translate the condition. So this condition over here is equivalent to having a closed phi form. C, A, B, C of Y equal to zero. So we have, so this means there is a closed phi form to all orders in alpha prime, because this argument is just based on symmetry. So we of course have, let's say, a suspect of what this K could be to leading order in alpha prime, but we don't need to use this. All we need are symmetries, and we know the symmetries are there to all orders in perturbation theory. So we know there's a closed phi form, closed four form. So exact phi form, whatever. So there's a closed four form to all orders in alpha prime. And basically, remember what we needed was that this was equal to beta was equal to dx psi. So basically, we would like to identify this, the closed phi form that exists here with this closed four form with this object over here. So basically, again, as I said, we just scratched the surface here. So we derive from general principles that there should always be a closed three form and a closed four form to all orders in alpha prime. This suggests but doesn't prove that these forms exist, because we still have not constructed the full action. We are ambitious. So we can, for example, we know how the entire space-time action looks like just for the bosonic field, so that we can write in a closed form. And we know how to write down pieces in superfield language, but we want the whole thing. And the difficult part are this massive spin two fields, because this is, now most of this we could find in Wessenbarger, of course. We wouldn't find those massive spin two fields in Wessenbarger, so we have to build up everything from scratch, basically. And that's it. Questions?
So the isometries of this form, scalar form and metric, are the gauge transformations of the free form and the morphism. Mm-hmm. Anything else?
So that's what you have in 11 dimensions. But then, of course, in the same way as the field content, basically, is very simple in 11 dimensions, but then splits into many fields in low dimensions. In the same way, the isometry. So we have diffeomorphisms up there, which become gauge transformations down here. Then it also becomes diffeomorphisms in space-time. Then we have the gauge transformations of the three form, which also become gauge transformations of a different gauge field. And then we have tensors that also transform. So they're all basically connected, all these fields. So we cannot basically just take one thing at a time. So I just wrote down an action here for chiral superfields, but there's also the vectors. But if we want something that satisfies all the symmetries that we get, we have to include the tensors, and all of those come together. More questions?
So I guess you did this for G2 because the space with the metric is directly from G4.
Well, we did it for G2 because it was sort of done in the 80s for Calabi-Yau manifolds, and not in this language, not in this language. In a different language that we also would like to have for this case, but we don't know how to do it, so we had to invent a new language. We, of course, depending on how frustrated we get, we keep switching from one theory to the other. Maybe this is easier in the theory. We have done enough cases.
So let's think again.